kind of going through quite a bit tonight. I'm not only going to talk about the development and combat history of the P-47, but can everybody hear me okay? Okay. I also want to talk about the new exhibit that's going to open tomorrow. And also, in conjunction with that exhibit, there was an aircraft restoration and an aircraft repaint. And I want to talk about that a little bit, too. Then at the end of the presentation, there's a video that's about 5 minutes long. It is absolutely unbelievable, astounding color footage from a P-47 outfit right at the end of World War II. It's the best aerial color footage I've seen of World War II, of the many hundreds of hours of footage I've seen. It's really incredible. We edited it down to a five-minute video for the exhibit. And then I'll answer any questions you might have, and then I'll invite everyone to take a brief visit to the P-47, take a look at the newly restored airplane. So I want to start out with the lineage of the P-47. You know, some airplanes, like the P-51, seem to come from out of nowhere. They seem to get the design just about right from the start. The P-47 wasn't like that. The P-47 came from a fairly long lineage of aircraft. It was started by Alexander de Seversky, and also there was a designer named Alexander Kartveli. They were both emigres from Russia. And de Seversky started building aircraft in the States in the early 1930s, and they had this sort of characteristic stubby shape. And there's a clear lineage. I've left out a few airplanes just for brevity here, but the first fighter that Seversky sold to the Army Air Corps was the P-35. And we do have a P-35 in the collection, fortunately. The P-35 was followed by the P-43, which is kind of a transition aircraft between the P-35 and the later P-47. And the thing about the P-43 is that it had a turbo supercharger, which I'll talk about a little bit more in just a minute. And then just a year after the P-43 entered service, which is the P-47 prototype. Now, an interesting thing about the P-47, the original XP-47B was supposed to be a lightweight, inline-engined interceptor. Weighed about 5,000 pounds or so. So clearly, there was a slight change in the requirement. And the XP-47B ended up being about 12,000 pounds gross weight, which is an enormous weight for a fighter in 1941. And in fact, that's just about the weight of the B-10 bomber. So, clearly the XP-47B has a lot of bulk. It's not a small fighter like the P-51. And one of the keys to the P-47, both its bulk and its performance, is its turbo supercharging system. In that illustration right here, all that area that is black is part of the turbo supercharger system. So if you take the skin off the P-47, a lot of the internal space is taken up with the turbo supercharger. What a turbo supercharger does basically, and I'm going to kind of simplify it, is the higher you go up in altitude, the thinner the air is, so that the engine can't mix the fuel with the air in the proper ratio. What a turbo supercharger does is it uses a system where it concentrates the air. So in effect, it's as if the plane is flying at a lower altitude. Now that would become very, very important later, especially in the air war over Europe, when our heavy bombers were flying at upwards of 30,000 feet. One great ancillary effect of this turbo supercharging system is if you look underneath, that's ducting for the turbo supercharger system. That was really fantastic in a belly landing on a P-47 because it provided cushioning. It wasn't intended to be that way, but that's just how it worked. The P-47 became known as the Jug. And that nickname came from its shape. It looked kind of like a milk bottle or a milk jug of the time, and particularly that photograph in the bottom right-hand corner really illustrates that. It's kind of funny because when I was writing the exhibit text for the P-47, an extended aircraft sign, I thought, you know, a lot of young people are going to have, even if I explain that the jug is like a milk bottle, they'll have no idea what a milk bottle looked like during World War II. So that's just too much to explain. They'll just have to look it up on the Internet. So. But the P-47B in the upper left-hand corner was kind of a service test model. They did build it, but it never did go into combat. But it was used in training in units in the States. And then the P-47C did end up being the first model to go into combat. Now, the early P-47s, they had some outstanding features that really remained through the whole series. P-47s, all of them were fast. All of them were rugged. They all had good roll rates. A lot of people don't think of the P-47 as being very maneuverable, and maybe not so much in turns, but as far as the roll rate was always outstanding on the P-47. It had 850 caliber machine guns, which is just an unbelievable amount of firepower for 1941. There were British fighters that had 8 machine guns as well, but they were rifle caliber machine guns. They weren't the heavy 50 caliber machine guns. So that was outstanding. And the early P-47s had a fast dive rate. Those were all really great features of the airplane. However, the early P-47s had a very poor climb rate, which is kind of unusual because even the heavy P-47 was to be an interceptor. And also it had a real problem with short range. There was only one large fuel tank right in front of the pilot. So those are real weaknesses in the early P-47s. The main production model was the P-47D, and about four-fifths of the production run were of the P-47D. And one characteristic of the P-47D is that the early models had the same shortcomings as the P-47Bs and Cs. But the Ds, it's really remarkable that they went through so many changes and didn't change the model designation to P-47E or P-47F, because some of the changes were pretty dramatic. In this photo, you can see what's probably the most visible change along the P-47D production run, going from the Razorbacks to the bubble tops. And the airplane on the right is an earlier model P-47D. There was a problem with that because the rear vision was not very good. And, of course, if somebody's behind you, you definitely want to be able to see that they're there. So about a third of the way through the production run, half the way through the production run, they went to this bubble top canopy, which provided much better visibility. Interestingly, the P-51 also went through that transition as well. Some of the other changes to the P-47D corrected the problems or the weaknesses of the early P-47s. One of those was to put drop tanks on the fuselage first, and then eventually also make it possible to hang drop tanks underneath the wings as well. It greatly extended the range. Another change were larger propellers, and we're very fortunate because there are two P-47s here at the museum. One's a Razorback, one's a bubble top. The Razorback has the earlier propeller. It's called a toothpick propeller, and the blades just really aren't that wide. And having propellers that narrow, having the blades that narrow, really couldn't take advantage of the power of the P-47's 2,000 horsepower engine. And so they changed the propellers on it to what they term paddle-bladed propellers. Our bubble top has the paddle-bladed propellers. So I would encourage you, as you're walking through the galleries, take a real close look at the early P-47D, then go take a look at the propeller on the later one, the bubble top, and you'll clearly see that. That greatly improved the climb on the P-47. So with those two changes, the problem of range and the problem of poor climb were largely rectified. I already mentioned the bubble top canopy. Now the wing mounts on the wings on the earlier airplanes, they didn't have those. The airplane was never meant to carry a bunch of bombs and a bunch of drop tanks. It just wasn't designed to do that, but it ended up being an ideal airplane to hang a lot of things on. So wing mounts were developed for bombs. They also developed some stub pylons to carry rockets, kind of much later in the P-47D run, closer to the end of the run, but it could carry up to 10 rockets on the wings. And also the original Mark 8 gun sight, which was a kind of a standard reflector gun sight, was changed to the K-14, which was the same gun sight that was on the P-51. Now, I mentioned a couple of the strengths of the P-47, and I want to illustrate those for you here. Look at all that ammunition. I mean, a big chunk of the wing was just to carry the rounds of 50 caliber machine gun rounds. But some pilots chose to have a couple of the guns taken out to save weight. Some of them didn't carry all the ammunition. They would rather have saved the weight. But full up, the airplane carried a tremendous amount of ammunition. Here's a good example of the firepower in this view. Now, recall that this is a tremendous load for a fighter in World War II, a single-engine fighter. It's not so surprising when we look at the jets now and you see an F-15E that's just loaded up with bombs under every surface under the wing. But during World War II, this is quite a bit of ordnance. There's, of course, the 8 machine guns. There's the rockets. Now, the earliest rockets that they carried were, they were not unlike bazookas, basically, grouped in threes and put underneath the wing. Later on, those the little stubs that they put on the wing to carry 10 rockets were much more aerodynamically clean. And, of course, once the rocket fired, then it's gone. With these tubes, they kept carrying the tubes. And lastly, the P-47, of course, could carry bombs. Typically, a P-47 that was on a ground attack mission would carry two 500-pound bombs and then a belly tank underneath for range. But it wasn't unusual for one to carry 2,000-pound bombs against hardened targets like dams, steel bridges, concrete bridges. So I made a point in the exhibit to put a 1,000-pound bomb on display next to the airplane. And it's just, you look at a P-47 with 2,000-pound bombs and you just think, it's not going to get up off the ground. Another load that was typically carried for airplanes that were equipped with the rocket stubs would be two 500-pound bombs, four rockets, and then a belly tank underneath. So, of course, the P-47 is tough. I think many of us have read about how much damage the P-47 could take. Again, it really wasn't designed to be that. It just turned out that that was an excellent design for ground attack. And in this case, this P-47 was hit by an 88 shell, which is really the best, probably the best anti-aircraft gun of the war. The pilot managed to make it back. Another thing that the turbo supercharging system did is it just was more metal between the pilot and fragments that could be coming into the cockpit. And in this case, the turbo supercharger underneath absorbed a lot of the damage. But this damage is pretty extensive, but the P-47 could take even more. The pilot in this airplane walked away and was flying missions within a week. What happened was this is a 9th Air Force airplane in Europe. He had a 500-pound bomb that was hung up on the wing. And he came into land, and as he was bumping along, the bomb came off and hit the ground, bounced a couple times, and then blew up and blew the whole back half of the airplane. I mean, look at, you can look through the wings. He walked away from that. So, that's pretty amazing. I think just about any other airplane, it would have killed the pilot. Now, the earliest combat service of the P-47 was in England, and the P-47 would become known as really as a ground attack fighter, but its first role was as an escort fighter. And I think it's often overlooked just how important the P-47 was through 1943 and early into early 1944 as one of the main escort fighters for the 8th Air Force. I mean, it was really, really important. And P-51 certainly had the range to get to Berlin and back and ended up sort of shouldering the load in 44. But the P-47 was essential in 1943 as an escort fighter. The first aircraft went to the 4th Fighter Group, and most of those pilots just absolutely hated them. Their airplanes that they had been flying were Spitfires. And many of them had been flying with the Eagle squadrons. So here they have this nimble inline engine fighter, very, very maneuverable. And then they hand them these P-47Cs with a poor climb rate. And one pilot said he was afraid he'd fall out of the seat and break his GD neck, if you know what I mean. Another one said that they knew how to fight with a P-47. They'd jump out of the cockpit and run around behind it and hide. It was so big. So except for Dwayne Beeson, who was an ace who ended up getting about 11 kills in the P-47, guys in the 4th Fighter Group did not like the P-47. They ended up going to P-51s later. However, this is a pretty telling statement. General Kepner was the head of the 8th Air Force's Fighter Command, 8th Fighter Command. And this is a quote that he made. If it can be said that the P-38 struck the Luftwaffe in its vitals and the P-51s are giving it the coup de grace, it was the Thunderbolt that broke its back. The Thunderbolt was an important escort fighter for the Army Air Forces through 1943. There were about 10 groups in the 8th Air Force that flew the P-47, and most of them eventually converted to the P-51, except for one, 56 Fighter Group Zemke's Wolf Pack, named after Hub Zemke, the commander. The 56 Fighter Group flying their P-47s had several aces, and many of you will recognize their names: Zemke, Gabreski in the middle there, highest scoring ace in the ETO with 28 kills. Robert S. Johnson, about 27 kills. Schilling, Zemke, Christensen. So the 56th were certainly not slackers flying their P-47. So although the P-47 really achieved fame as a ground attack aircraft in Europe, again, it's really important to remember during that critical time, the P-47 was a really important airplane. Like I mentioned, that the P-47 was really was a fighter bomber par excellence. It was for the times, it was pretty much ideal. It was fast. With the additional range added on with the tanks, it had a good range, very, very tough, and could carry a tremendous amount of firepower. And what happened was there was a conscious decision made that as the P-47 was somewhat struggling with the range issue and P-51s were starting to come online, a decision was made the P-51 is going to be the long-range escort fighter in Europe, and the P-47 is going to be the primary fighter bomber in Europe. So, and that's what ended up happening, and really it was a smart decision. The P-47 could take a lot more damage. It didn't have the vulnerability of a liquid-cooled engine like the P-51, and the P-51 really already had the range. So that really worked out well. So we'll shift over to the Pacific. There were many groups that flew the P-47 in the Pacific, and it's kind of an unknown thing, but there were several groups that did. They were initially used in New Guinea and then later in the Philippines, and they were kind of a multi-role fighter. They were used as interceptors, fighter bombers, long-range escort fighters. Early on, there were a lot of issues with people thought, you know, the Zero is so nimble, these Japanese airplanes are so nimble, how is the P-47 going to combat the Zero? And one pilot who proved that the P-47 was really more than a match for any Japanese fighter was Neil Kirby. And he commanded the most famous of the P-47 units, the 348. And what Kirby did is he just used the strengths of the P-47 to advantage. He would stay high, that turbo supercharger would keep the P-47 nimble at high altitude, and then just scream down on a Japanese formation, make a pass, and then zoom climb back up. The Japanese aircraft couldn't even come close. And if those machine guns touched the Japanese airplanes, they would just disintegrate. So he taught that to his pilots, and they were very successful. Kirby ended up getting 22 kills. He was caught at low altitude going after a Japanese fighter and was killed near WEWAC. And we have some of his artifacts on display out in front of the museum's Razorback P-47, which is also painted like his airplane. And also we have the tail from his airplane that he was killed in. It was discovered in New Guinea and brought here to the museum. So I encourage you to take a look at it. The only other really major model beyond the P-47D was the N model, and the N model was really the pinnacle. It really was a fantastic airplane. It was used in the Pacific, used as B-29 escort, but it was also used to do ground strafing against the Japanese home islands. And what they did with the P-47N essentially was a considerably more powerful R-2800 engine. It was an upgraded R-2800 engine. It had 800 more horsepower than the earlier R2800s used on the D-Mod. Had 2800 horsepower, which is tremendous. And they put a stub that was about 20 inches on either side of the fuselage and put fuel tanks in it. And then they cut the wingtips off and squared them off to keep that good roll rate. And it had a range of almost 2,000 miles, which is astounding. And had the war continued on, the P-47N would have been an even more important airplane and probably better known, but it was used in combat before the end of the war. And lastly, the P-47 was used in the China-Burma-India theater. It didn't really make it there until spring of 44, and there were about five groups that used it, including the 1st Air Commando Group. One characteristic sign of a P-47 in the CBI theater, particularly with the 1st Air Commando Group, is if you look just behind the cockpit, that loop right there is a direction finding aerial. Flying out around the Himalayas and CBI was pretty dangerous, so they put this direction finding equipment on the airplanes to make it easier for them to make their way back to base. There were also several other users of the P-47, not just the U.S. Army Air Forces, and Brazil used the P-47. They flew in Italy. We just received a gift this week from the Brazilian Air Force, a P-47 panel that's painted with some artwork, and that will be going on display probably in the next couple months here, so look for that. Also, Free France, Great Britain, Mexico, and the Soviet Union flew P-47s. The Mexican unit flew in the Pacific. And then after the war, the Army Air Forces and later the U.S. Air Force continued to fly the P-47D and the P-47N into the mid-50s. By then, it was in Air National Guard units. But an interesting thing about the P-47, in 47-48, it was redesignated the F-47. And when the Korean War broke out, there were a couple of P-51 outfits that were based in Japan, and they were very important early in the Korean War. They were later replaced in late 52, early 53 with jet fighters. But problem with the P-51 with ground attack is its liquid cool engine was very vulnerable to fire. There was a puncture in the line, all of the glycol would leak out, and then the engine would overheat. So General Stratemeyer, who was the head of Far East Air Forces, actually requested to get F-47s brought into the Korean theater to use them. But his request was denied because it would have added complications to logistics to bring in another airframe, and there were many who doubted the utility of piston engine aircraft in the jet age. So they never did go to Korea. Now I'd like to talk about the exhibit that's going to open tomorrow. It's called Down to Earth. That name comes from an 8th Air Force directive called Down to Earth, and it was this idea that aircraft that were doing long-range escort would peel off, and if after they get the bombers out of the area of hazard, then they would go and strafe ground targets. So I thought that was a good name for the exhibit. But the exhibit is not really about the 8th Air Force primarily, but it's about the 9th and 12th Air Forces. And basically, the 9th Air Force was based in Western Europe. The 12th Air Force was based in Southern Europe. And their primary job was tactical air power. The types of airplanes that for attack that they flew were primarily the P-47. There were some P-38s and one P-51 outfit, but most of these were ended up being replaced by P-47 groups. Medium bombers like the B-26 Marauder, and then light attack aircraft like the A-20 Havoc and the A-26 Invader. And we're very fortunate; we have all of those aircraft in the collection. The B-26 Marauder and the A-20 Havoc are in the World War II gallery. And the A-26 Invader is in the Korean War Gallery by the time of Korea had been renamed the B-26, but it's the same airplane. Real quickly, for those of you who might not be aware, tactical air power basically focuses on supporting ground troops and the ground forces as opposed to strategic. And strategic primarily targeted the enemy homeland, factories, and things like that. Tactical air power for attack, the main mission was to gain air superiority and then conduct interdiction and close air support operations. But another part of tactical air power is airlift, like the C-47s that drop paratroopers on D-Day, and also tactical reconnaissance. But that's not a focus in this exhibit, just the attack part of it. But it's good to know that it was the tactical air forces that did that airlift and reconnaissance. Sometimes the tactical air forces were supplemented by the strategic air forces in Europe. It was very frustrating for some of those who were commanding the strategic air forces because they kept wanting to hit these strategic targets. But there were times when the higher leadership felt it was important to focus on the ground operations, like preparing for D-Day during that time and right after D-Day. What the 9th Air Force did to prepare for D-Day, and it was really essential, was to hit enemy airfields, to hit strong points. In the picture there, that's Pont du Hoc, and that was an important German position in Normandy. That was right square in the middle of the D-Day landing, so that was hit several times. They also aimed to cut transportation, destroy supply dumps, and the V-1s had started to be fired, so they went after V-1 sites as well. This is a great illustration. We're very fortunate to have a collection from the 9th Air Force commander. And this is one illustration that was in his photo book from the campaign in Europe. And this is a graphic illustration of one of the aims of the 9th Air Force before D-Day, which was to cut all of the bridges across the Seine River. And if you look at it, the enemy was expecting us to land in Pas-de-Calais, which is up here. And by dropping all these bridges, when the Allies landed here, the Germans had a heck of a time trying to get across the Seine to counterattack. They did the same thing with bridges. It's not on the map, but they did the same thing with bridges down and rivers along here. That was very... So when the Allies landed on D-Day, the 9th Air Force kind of switched some of their operations to try and hit enemy reinforcements. And it got to the point where the Germans really could hardly move during daytime. They were forced to move at night because anything that moved during the day was strafed or bombed. And that what the key to D-Day was that the Allies would be able to build up supplies into the beachhead faster than the Germans could counterattack and bring their forces to the beachhead. And in the end, the tactical Air Force, the 9th Air Force, and of course supported by the British and strategic air forces, was absolutely essential in cutting off German reinforcement. But about a month and a half after D-Day, the line looked something like this. They had gained a fair amount of territory, but only about 25 miles inland. So the big breakout came at San Lo in Operation Cobra. And basically, the 9th Air Force, along with the strategic air forces, absolutely and completely pounded St. Lo. They dropped tons and tons of bombs on St. Lo. And then when it stopped, Allied ground forces punched right through. And it absolutely broke the German line. As the Allies were landing and building up at D-Day, there were also airstrips being built for the 9th Air Force. And in fact, there was one functioning within about 3 days of the D-Day landing. And that would become characteristic of the 9th Air Force through to the end of the war. Unlike the 8th Air Force, the 9th Air Force lived on the continent. They lived at forward air bases. As the Army moved forward, the engineers moved forward, built airstrips, and airplanes started to land in there. And then they started flying operations. So a lot of times these guys, the ground crewmen, the pilots, they lived in tents, fairly rough field conditions. The maintenance was usually conducted outdoors, whether it's snowing or raining or whatever the weather is. So it was kind of a hard life. And also, I think it contributed somewhat to that the strategic air forces got a little bit more recognition because they were based in England. And it's a lot better to cover an air force that's in a civilized condition as opposed to being at the front lines in the mud. So I don't think that the 9th Air Force maybe got some of the same press as the strategic air forces did. Well, here's another illustration from that scrapbook I was mentioning. This represents San Lo right here. There was ground forces moved north and ground forces moved south and tried to cut off the German forces that were trying to get out. And it's really an amazing thing. In the 9th Air Force, there were basically two fighter commands. There was the 9th and the 19th. On this drive here, that was Patton's 3rd Army. And Patton didn't want to deal with his right flank. He just wanted to move forward. But not having covering forces on his right flank left him very, very vulnerable to a counterattack right into his flank. So he asked the 9th Fighter Command, or the 19th Fighter Command, cover my right flank. And that's exactly what they did. His right flank was covered by air. And it worked great. And then in the north, the other half of the 9th Air Force's fighter bomber force, they developed a technique of covering the armored columns and flying ahead. And Otto Weiland was the general in command of Patton's right flank. And then General Quesada was in charge of the fighter force that was in the north. And there was a brilliant tactic that Quesada developed called the armored column cover. And an Air Force pilot, Army Air Force's pilot, would be in a tank with an armored column. They're way out ahead of our artillery, way out ahead of our main forces, driving forward. And he would be in radio communication with fighter bombers overhead. And these fighter bombers would range in front of the armored columns. And as many of you know, our Shermans were not really a match one-on-one to many of the German tanks, the Tiger and the Panther. But these fighter bombers, mostly P-47s, would roam ahead. And then when they found enemy armored forces, they would report them to the armored columns and then attack. So they did two things. They did reconnaissance, but then they also did attack. And air power did an awful lot to destroy enemy armor. We would have lost a lot more people without the development of this tactic by Quesada. Well, as our armies paused to drive into Germany towards the end of 1944, there was a surprise attack called the Battle of the Bulge in the Ardennes Forest. And it looked to be a disaster early on. The weather was awful, and the Germans had planned it that way because they had to keep our airplanes grounded. And it was real touch and go for a while. But finally, on December 23rd, the weather cleared, and then it was just a turkey shoot. And in particular, 9th Air Force started hitting German troops, German columns. In the upper left-hand corner there is a railroad yard just inside the German border. So they were not only hitting the enemy at the front, they were also destroying their supply lines to supply their tanks and troops at the front. And air power, absolutely, along with some incredible valor by the troops on the ground in Bastogne and some other places, halted the German attack and absolutely crushed it. The Allies went into Germany in 1945, and by this point, there was almost no opposition left from the Luftwaffe, and 9th Air Force aircraft roamed freely over Germany, and basically the Germans couldn't move at all. And these are some pictures of ground targets in Germany in 1945. The other main tactical air force was the 12th Air Force, and they were in southern Europe. And I think the important thing to remember about the 12th Air Force, they had basically the same mission as the 9th Air Force in western Europe. But the important thing about the 12th Air Force, there were four large amphibious landings in southern Europe. And in two of those landings in particular, the 12th Air Force was essential. One of those landings was at Anzio, which is right there. There was a German line called the Gustav Line, and it seemed like it couldn't be broken. It's in mountainous terrain. These murderous attacks kept failing over and over. And so the idea was to land in Anzio and then drive behind the Germans. Well, the landing got kind of stuck, and it was touch and go for a while there. It looked like our troops are going to get pushed off the beachhead, but air power stemmed a lot of the German attacks and was essential in keeping our forces from being pushed into the sea. And then the other landing where air power was really essential was the landing in southern France called Operation Dragoon. And this really caught the Germans by surprise, and we had total air superiority. And there was one place where there were 2,000 German vehicles that were destroyed in one relatively small location. They tried to, because by then we had already landed at D-Day, and they just tried to retreat, and they couldn't hide from air power. So the other characteristic of the 12th Air Force in southern Europe are helping break these German defensive lines. There was an operation called Operation Strangle, where they dropped bridges and hit enemy targets to try and kind of wrap a noose around Italy to keep them from supplying the Gustav Line. And it wasn't totally successful, but it definitely did contribute to slowing down German supplies. Later, they also helped break the Gothic Line. Italy was called the soft underbelly of Europe, but it was anything but that. It's very mountainous terrain, and it was an awful lot of hard slogging. So air power was really helpful in southern Europe as well. Some of the artifacts in the exhibit, we're very fortunate. We ended up getting some really remarkable artifacts of this exhibit. One just came in this week, and it's the Medal of Honor and other decorations awarded to Lieutenant Raymond Knight. And Raymond Knight was really, really quite amazing. He had already flown over 80 combat missions. He'd been wounded twice. He was always eager to get at the enemy. And about a week before the war ended, he volunteered to go and hit enemy airfields. And he hit one airfield, but he was leading a flight. And he told the other three in the flight, "You stay up here. I'm going to fly down real low and eyeball the airfield and see where the airplanes are. Then I'll come back and then I'll lead you guys and we can hit the airplanes." So his airplane got hit, and he flew it back. And then he flew a second mission that day. His airplane got hit again. And then the next day, he volunteered to go against this same airfield, and it was really heavy flak. And his airplane got hit pretty badly. And he was trying to coax it back over the mountains, and he just missed clearing a mountaintop and flew his airplane into the mountain. He was killed. And then a week later, the war ended. So, you know, by that point, it could certainly be, I think, forgiven if it looked like the war was about to end, you know, that you know, they could let off a little bit, but he didn't. You know, he stayed with it, and he paid the ultimate price for it. But we have his medals on display now, and so it'd be great to tell his story to the millions of people that come to the museum. Another major artifact is a 20 millimeter flak Fearling anti-aircraft system. The thing about the flak Fearling is that the Luftwaffe had been pretty much wiped out by 1945. I mean, they had some airplanes flying, but they were really in desperate straits. But the anti-aircraft fire continued to increase in intensity throughout 44 and into 1945. And particularly for the P-47 pilots, their mission profile got them real low when they were strafing. And particularly these flak Fearling guns, and it was basically 4 20-millimeter guns, were deadly. And if they got hit badly at low altitude, there's no ejection seat, so they're too low to bail out, so they have to try and belly the airplane in. And if they got hit bad enough and the airplane came apart, there was no hope. So we lost quite a few people to these 20-millimeter flak Fearling guns. Also in front of that are some artifacts, some items that were worn and used by German anti-aircraft gunners. Another artifact which is really, really fun to look at is that it's a Mark 8 gun sight. That's the earlier gun sight that P-47s used. And our exhibit staff figured out a way to get a light inside of that gun sight so you can look through and you can see the reticle that a P-47 pilot would see. It's really remarkable. The way the optics are, the sight kind of floats on this glass panel. So I do encourage you to take a look at that. We also have P-47 armor plate that's on display. That's one of the things that made the P-47 tough and protected its pilots. And then a really interesting gun sight that was used by A-26 gunners. It had two turrets, but one gunner could use this one gun sight to control the turrets. And lastly, the biggest artifact is our P-47D bubble top Thunderbolt. And there's a real personal story here. General Metcalf was looking to get our airplane restored and repainted as a 9th Air Force P-47. There were 16 groups that flew P-47s in the 9th Air Force. So we're talking about 48 squadrons or so. So it's literally hundreds and hundreds of different airplanes it could have been. Well, once we discovered the story of Colonel Joseph Laughlin, there wasn't really a close second. Laughlin was the commander of the 362nd Fighter Group from August 1944 to the end of the war, and he was really a great commander and a great pilot. Here are some pictures of our P-47D being restored. It wasn't just a repaint. There was some repair that had to be done on the aircraft, and our restoration staff did that. So it wasn't just repainting the airplane. Some of the things about Colonel Laughlin, he was a good commander. One thing was because he really cared about his people, and he demonstrated that over and over again. He kept up morale pretty high, even though they were losing a lot of pilots. He also led from the front, and he was a great fighter-bomber pilot. His airplane was nicknamed 5x5, and unfortunately, Colonel Laughlin passed away in February, but we did get the chance to talk to him a little bit before he passed away. And he had kidded around that 5x5 is a radio signal, I hear you 5x5, but also, and it's a song. But he said he was also 5x5 because he was 5 foot tall and 5 feet wide. You know, he's a little self-conscious about his weight. He was also credited with sinking a light cruiser in Brest in 1944. And it's really neat because it's painted on the side of his airplane. So I've seen plenty of airplanes with German aircraft kills and maybe train and truck kills. But I think that's the only one in Europe I've seen with a ship. Another thing that he did... there was the Duza Dam was flanking an area that the Third Army, Patton's Third Army, was going to go through. And they were really concerned that the Germans would just let go of the dam as they were trying to advance through that area. So this huge wall of water would rush through and wash away his army. They were very, very concerned about that. So they ordered Colonel Laughlin to take his unit and to try and bomb the sluice gate and just hit it just enough that it would be opened up so the dam could slowly drain. You know, so it's kind of like just kind of damage it, but don't break it, which is kind of a lot to ask, especially at this time and without precision weapons. Well, Colonel Laughlin dropped his bombs the closest, worked exactly like it was supposed to. It damaged the sluice gate enough that the water slowly drained from this dam. And Colonel Laughlin got a personal phone call from General Patton saying what a great job he did. So there are many reasons why we picked that scheme for that airplane. And we talked to Colonel Laughlin's family, and they've been nothing but generous. They donated artifacts so that we can put those on display. So tonight, when we go back and look at the airplane after the presentation, do take a look at that case with his objects in it. Lastly, before we go to that video I was talking about, I want to highlight another guy who was in Laughlin's unit. Colonel Laughlin was originally the commander of the 379th Fighter Squadron, which is one of the squadrons of the 362nd. And George Rary was a commercial artist before the war, and a very talented one at that. And he went to the military after the war started, trained to be a fighter pilot, and he was a fighter pilot in the 379th. And he painted a whole bunch of their airplanes with this really neat cartoon-like nose art. He's really, really talented. And on the bottom right there, you can see that's one of the ones. He painted the 5x5 on Colonel Laughlin's airplane. He also, for each of the pilots, he did a portrait. And then he also did a watercolor of their nose art. And then he also had all kinds of sketches on the bottom there. You can see where it says stud. He's made a drawing of himself painting nose art on the cowling of a P-47. So he really put his hand on a lot of these airplanes. But unfortunately, George Rary was killed about a month after D-Day. But his artwork still remains. And it's kind of an interesting thing that somebody would have so much expression and have so much talent in art and in the midst of this war and going from rough airfield to rough airfield. There's a panel on him as well in the exhibit.